Well, good evening. Good to see everybody tonight. Psalm 63 was an early Christian's favorite morning hymn. The reason it was considered morning is the old King James translates the Hebrew word in that first sentence that is earnestly in the English standard as early. Early I will seek you. So it was looked at as being a psalm to start the day off. Theodore Beza, who was one of the great leaders of the Protestant Reformation, when he could not sleep at night because of one of the refrains in this psalm, would recite this psalm to himself. As he said, he would rejoice in his spirit even if he couldn't sleep. John Chrysostom, who was the bishop of Constantinople in the 4th century A.D., of course the church had gone way wide of what God intended by that point, but he was known for his effective preaching. It was told it was his favorite psalm. Title of the psalm, as you know, titles came at a much later date, says, A Psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. Well, the wilderness of Judah could be a lot of times, as we have been studying the life of David and thinking about the pursuit that Saul had of him all over Judah, that God would not even let him go outside of the land. You remember that time he was in Moab. There were times he went among the Philistines, and that always proved disastrous. But most people have fixed this psalm as when Absalom pursues him. David, as you know, would have been full of great perplexity. This is the route that they had to take from Jerusalem, the red line, as he would pass through Gilgal or Jericho, one of them, and then on up to where we know they think Mahanaim is. We talked about that in the class. Nobody knows what the force of Ephraim or the battle was fought between Israel and those that followed King David. But the decisive victory that came on the part of God overthrowing Ahithophel and overthrowing Absalom utterly and completely. David is full of perplexity, full of grave difficulties. We can only imagine what it would have been like. This is the country that he had to flee through. This is what it looks like today. The Judean wilderness that is west of Jericho to the east and the south of Jerusalem. This ancient wadi, wadis were the dry riverbeds that fill up in water in the spring, sometimes a rush with flowing water, much like the hill country in Texas or any place that is arid like that. That road there is a modern road, but it is following an ancient path. It would have been much the road that they would have traveled from Jericho, what you could read in the New Testament and think of the man that fell among the thieves. This is that wadi looking at it more closely. Obviously, they would have needed water, and this is a modern spring that still flows out of that, would have in ancient times too. And so you can imagine David and them fleeing through such country. Not only the hostility of that, but knowing that at any point, if they follow the Hittites' advice, and David's a man of war, he could very easily believe that they would come after him as quickly as possible. That would have been the right move from a human standpoint. Ahithophel knew it was. But you remember that Hushai defeated the council of Ahithophel and to the disaster as God had intended to bring upon Absalom. So during very difficult times, as David had to handle in that very hard, hard testing of him, you and I are going to have times of grave difficulty. The Psalms are filled with that, filled with the hard, hard times that each of us can have in life. And we come to see ourselves for who we really are. As one man said, adversity introduces a man to himself. When we finally have grave difficulties in our life, it is only then that we really find out how weak we are. That we find out how we have lacked shoring ourselves up and building strength in an area, but we are introduced to who we really are. And many times we're going to walk away from that and not really like who we are. So how do we get better? Well, we get better by studying God's Word that applies to those kinds of times and think about what we need to do in order to be right with Him. Adversity is the great teacher. It drives the believer to God. He begins this psalm by saying, O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. You think about what they had to descend through as they went through the Judean wilderness and how vivid all of that would be in the mind of David. This is a tremendously important point. There are people that we thought of as Christians. They're all around us. There are folks that you could name that I don't know yet, longer that I'm here, that I will know. And some of us will quit following God. Such grave difficulties will hit our lives and we will no longer walk. A marriage has terrible difficulty and busts up, and then either one or both of those parties just simply leave the Lord. The adversity that happens in a home when a baby is born and there's all kinds of terrible, terrible difficulties. One of the things that we learned, Will and I did, of having Jonathan when he was born with so many difficulties is how many marriages fail when children are born with terrible, terrible problems. The figure was almost 90% of those marriages fail. Again, adversity introduces us to ourselves. And when we have children that leave the Lord, that same kind of pressure is put on a marriage. That same kind of pressure when we lose all of our children is just brings to the forefront things that we just never would have seen otherwise. We never would have had to face. We may say things like often is said, why has God done this to me? We are like the story we looked at this morning of Naomi. Don't call me gracious, which is what Naomi meant. Call me Mara, which means bitterness. And do we turn to that? Do we turn away from God, doubting His love and His care for us? Are we like Job's wife and we just say, curse God and die? True believers do the exact opposite. They draw nearer to God. Oh God, You are my God in adversity. Simon Peter said the right words, as he so often did, say some of the most bumbling things and then say things that were so right. When he said, do you want to go away too? Many turned and walked no more with him, we are told in that chapter. And Simon Peter said, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we have come to believe that You are the Christ. And because of that, they were not going to walk away, though perplexed they may be. They did not despair on God. Rather, they clung to Him more tightly, as we all must. Remember Jesus. Remember the warnings and the exhortations that are given to us in that. Remember Jesus, who endured the sufferings of the cross, but for the joy that was set before Him, He endured those sufferings. Knowing what was coming in victory at the end of it, He was willing to endure the harshness of the cross that we probably will never have to go through, the kind of thing that He went through. Never would we probably feel what He felt to be God in the flesh and know that His Father had to turn His back on Him as He was the sacrifice offered for all the sins of mankind. True Christians turn to God knowing that He is our Father. And because He is our Father, He loves us. They go to God because they know Him. Lots of godless and irreligious people pray to God in a crisis. It's an act of desperation. It doesn't flow from the lifeblood in them. Every year, this time of year, I have to watch sometime. I just started it. It's a Wonderful Life, and I refuse to watch it in the colored versions. But there is that scene where he prays to God. And I mean, it reflects so many modern things made so many, many years ago, yet reflecting a godless person. George Bailey is not somebody. He said, God, remember when he was praying? If you're up there, hear me. I need your help. And the whole time there is that providential thing, it seems to be going on in the movie that God is listening and He is going to take care of him. But here is a guy that doesn't care about God at all. And at the end, he's only in desperation reaching out to Him. But the language of a true believer is, oh God. The explanation is not like we hear people who are godless in society. They use His name like it was a curse word. They use it attached to curse words. How often you're with somebody and you cringe when they say, oh God. That's not the way it's said here. Oh God, the exclamation of a believer, not blasphemy, the depth of the feeling. Oh God, You are, or Thou art my God. The personal relationship. The fact that they know with confidence, as the Hebrew author said, let us then with boldness, confidence, the English standard says, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We do not come to a God who we don't know. We come to a God that we know. Think about parents. To what length would we go to rescue our children? To what length did we go, Will and I, to take care of Jonathan when he was a little bitty baby and all of those things? I know I'm probably embarrassing you, but it's my illustration. To all the lengths we would go, in money, in time, in effort, it did not matter to rescue him, to bring him back to health if God allowed it and others could help us do that, that had the skills. There is no end that a parent would not go to rescue their children. So remember, that's our God. He is our Father, and He loves us that way. The true desire of the believer then is to know God. My soul thirsts for you or for thee. We do not come to God as a last resort. Pray because, well, you know it can't hurt. We come like Psalms 42, verse 1 and 2, as we were singing, as a deer pants for the flowing streams. So pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before you? It's that longing for God that drives David more than the deliverance. It is to know God and have God. Hezekiah, we read that story about the Babylonian envoys coming and inquiring about the great sign where he had prayed that the shadow might back up on the steps, and it had. And so the Babylonians, we know, Egyptians, others, were interested in the stars and the heavens, and they sent envoys to find out about it. And it says these stark words, when the envoys came, it says, God left him to himself. Can you imagine what a horror that would be if Hezekiah had known that? If he had known that God had withdrawn himself from Hezekiah to test him and see what was in him. Now David, in some sense, is like that. Maybe it was in reality that he's paying for the sins that Nathan said, this is going to happen to you. From your own house, a sword is going to arise, and you'll never know peace. In a dry and thirsty land, surrounded by enemies, knowing who can he trust, who can he not, they come and tell him Ahithophel on the flight out has become his enemy. And so that longing and thirsting for God's presence. And I wonder sometimes if I even know what it is to long for God. When we have it so well in our country, do we come to services anticipating the joy and the strength and the blessing that we will get from it? Do we worship? Or is it just, you know, if we're on a vacation, we got to find a spot. You got to find a spot, you know. It's kind of like the guy that said they had a family come in to the congregation right at the end of services were over, basically. And this guy comes in and he said, can we take the Lord's Supper? And so you're thinking, well, stuff could have happened. You might not could have gotten here. You're not trying to judge everybody's situation. But then the guy spilled his hand. He said, well, can I run it out to my wife who's in the car? And the preacher looked at him and said, I tell you what, we have a drive-up window over here. Just come by and we'll serve you out the window. I mean, the point he was making was, is that what you think God is? Like it's some kind of Pepto-Bismol, not Pepto-Bismol, but stuff that old people used to take for... Calvin, you're rubbing off on me. There's stuff that's happening to me. Anyway, any of those drinks that you boost and those kind of things that you're drinking, is that what we think God is? If we do that, it's just it's a boost. Not if our heart's not right. Not if we're not seeking God with all that's inside of us. The Super Bowl is way, way more important. Or the need to study this time of year. You got your finals this week, but you're all here, every one of you, because you love God and you want God. And then he says in verse 2, I have looked upon you in the sanctuary to behold you. And you think about how much we need each other, how much we need to worship at the temple, as it were, with them and you and I gathering together to do that. And David needs his assurance in the wilderness. There are times that people will leave us. As Paul would say when he was standing at my first defense, no one stood with me. All deserted me. But the Lord stood with me, he said, and strengthened me. And so God grants this, as the Philippian author says, the peace that surpasses all understanding. We love our spouse, and the one who loves wants to know that he is loved or she is loved in return. We don't want to be taken for granted. We need the one we love to reaffirm that love. How many times do we get into some kind of argument with our spouse? And in the end, that's what it finally is about. It's about somebody has neglected the other one. And this relationship between us and God is that same way. God is not to be neglected. And God is to be given His due and His part as much as we need it and know that we need His love for us. And so He says to us that God's steadfast love is better than even life. The Philippi author Paul said, "For to me to live is Christ." I wonder if I could write that outside Chuck Durham's name. Could I say, if you looked at Chuck, would you say, "I see Christ"? That's what I see. I doubt any of us. We're shooting for that. But I doubt any of us could say, as the Apostle Paul said, and feel with confidence almost that nobody would have objected to Paul and said, "No, that's not true." Of Paul, "For to me to live is Christ." But of the rest of us, do we live with that kind of grip on God and His steadfast love is more important than life itself? You know, with most of us, the most important thing is prolonging our existence here and to what lengths we will go to do that. Death is the final calamity to everyone in this world. In 1 John chapter 2:17, "The world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. We are passing away as well. We are transient and ephemeral and passing." As James says, "What is your life? You are a mist or a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away." And the world wants us to do what they do. Let's just focus on entertainment, on sports, and on politics, and on books, and on music, and on everything else. And all the while forgetting that we're a ticking time bomb. It's just a matter of when. If we go 90 years, so what? You're not likely to go 100, 110. Sooner or later, we meet God. And here, the Hebrew author says those powerful words in chapter 13, 14, "For here we have no lasting city." Here, this earth, we have no continuing city, if we use the old King James. "For the things that are seen," as Paul said, "are transient. The things that are unseen are eternal." As David Martin Lloyd-Jones said in his book, Seeking the Face of God, "You are taken ill, you wonder whether you're going to get well, and then you recover, thank God. And then you forget what it felt like at that awful moment. But that is where you show yourself to be a poor fool who does not know how to think. You have only had a temporary respite because it is only a postponement. That is the wisdom of the Bible. Here we have no continuing city." There's a man down in the congregation that we moved from that fought cancer. He whipped it along with the aid of all the medicines that he was taking, all the chemo, all of that. But he said to his family, "Since I've gone through that the first time, I'm not going through it the second time. If this comes back, we're not doing it again. The cost is that great." Those that fought cancer are the only ones who can know that I'm sure he speaks absolutely from the heart. "It was too hard. It was too awful. I'll do it once. But the next time I'm not." Because what is he saying? That all I did was postpone it. All I did was buy more time. But the next time, I'm not doing that. Because the next time, death is coming. And you and I understand that if we will look at our lives the way that God wants us to. This world cannot ultimately satisfy our deepest needs. I have been interested in the stuff of life. I've been attracted to it, been helped by it. I've been moved by it. I've enjoyed the things that are right. But in the end, if I were to do them 24/7, 365 days a year, it is not enough. It cannot fill the part of me that was made for God, as the great author Augustine said in his Confessions, "For thou hast formed us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find rest in thee." That God-shaped vacuum, someone has written, that nothing else we pour into it can fill. Only God can fill that. Those cares and riches of the world we are choked by. The pleasures of life. But as the book of Ecclesiastes argues, vanity of vanities. All is vanity and a vexation or a striving after wind. C.S. Lewis rightly said, "If I find a desire that no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." God alone can fill that part of us, not money, not the things that money can buy or any pleasure that's on this side of eternity. The quote that's before you comes out of a book that Batzel Barrett Baxter wrote. It was called "I Believe Because." He wrote a lot about apologetics in it, but there is a chapter in there that is worth so much. It's called that what skeptics, those that were unbelievers, what they said when they had lived out life. And folks, it's just the book of Ecclesiastes. This is Mark Twain, the quote from his autobiography. "A myriad of men are born, they labor and sweat and struggle, age creeps upon them, infirmities follow, shames and humiliations bring down their vanities. Those they love are taken from them, and the joy of life is turned to aching grief. And they vanish from a world where they were of no consequence, where they achieved nothing, or they were a mistake and a failure, a world which will lament them a day and forget them forever. Then another myriad takes their place and copies all they did and goes along the same profitless road and vanishes as they vanished to make room for other myriads to follow the same arid path and accomplish nothing." The person that lives only for here, that is Ecclesiastes. That is what the author of that great book says. There's nothing here that ultimately can satisfy. And so the Christian seizes the steadfast love of God. When we fell in love with our mate, when we fell in love with our husband or our wife, we know the desire to be in the presence of the one that we love. Do you remember that? Do you remember how you just, you could not, you're in the middle of a class, you're in the middle of doing something, writing a paper, doing whatever it was at work, and you couldn't help but think about them. It was just constantly on your mind. Listen to him. Look at verse 5. "God is better than the best meal you ever ate. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips." Man, I didn't know if I would ever eat barbecue again as good as Texas. But along came Wright's. And I went in there and ordered their lean brisket. And that good smoked, seared part that has that black and red, and the peppers are in there, you know, the peppercorns. And then that smoke flavor, and it just melts in your mouth. And you eat it, and you realize there's hope for here. And then I was eating with my brother Jake, and he said, "But have you tried the pie?" And particularly, we went and shared a piece of honey, salted honey pie from the Fork and Crust place. And oh my goodness, people, that was the best pie I believe I have ever eaten. And now y'all are all saying, "Get through with this sermon so we can go on." You know how great a meal can be. I mean, just how fabulous it can be. How a steak just melts in your mouth and the flavors and you're salivating before you even put it in. And you know that. And he says, "My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food." It's better than any meal that you ever ate. This love for God and seeking God. It will help you in the middle of the night, as Beza did when he would quote this when he could not sleep at night at verse 6. "When I remember you upon my bed and meditate upon you in the watches of the night." At times when we all can't sleep. What a joy it would be if we had memorized this chapter and that we would, like him, quote it to ourselves. And to say, as verse 7 says, you are my help, my soul clings to you at verse 7. And at verse 8, your right hand upholds me. A child that runs to protection in the solace of a parent's arms. Why did they do that? Did they have perfect understanding of a storm's danger? Even a little kid would know that a parent can't save them from that F1 tornado. But an F1 tornado, there might be a room in the house, there might be a place where they can take them. And they trust them implicitly. And it's enough for them. They can grab hold of mom or daddy's leg or be in their arms to know they're safe. And so verses 9 through 11, he says, the enemies of God and that my enemies, he says, will be destroyed, basically. The king shall rejoice in God, all who swear by him shall exult. In the mouths of liars, all those that are opposed to God will be stopped. And so, to mark it all, I think, verses 3 through 5, we should be filled with thanksgiving, as he is. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. In your name I will lift up my hands. My soul shall be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips. Choose wisely in life. Choose wisely. And don't go the path of the world. Go the path of David, those that have loved God. If you're subject to heaven's invitation this night, Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. If we can help you tonight to come back to him if you need to, or to begin to walk with him while we stand and while we sing.